going to mug me?
Am I going to mug you?
Is that gorgeous or what, eh?
And I believe I can run a decent marathon.
Download Veely now.
My name is Martina Cole. I'm a crime author. The nature of true crime often defies understanding or logic. And in my opinion, the most difficult perpetrators of crime to work out are the women that murder time and time again. In this series, I'll be shining a light on six of the most prolific female mass murderers in history. So welcome to the dark world of the lady killers. In my work as a crime writer, research is everything, and I don't just focus on modern criminals. My fascination with women who kill has unearthed more than a few lady killers from history. This is the story of Mary Ann Cotton. Born in 1832, she was a 19th century killing machine, and no one in her life was safe. Not her husband, not her stepkids, not her mother, and certainly not her own children. A chilling serial killer who may have killed up to 21 people. For her crimes, she was hanged in Durham Jail in 1873.
For people like Mary Ann Cotton, life was war. You had to do whatever you had to do to survive.
When I came across this story, I was immediately fascinated by Mary Ann Cotton. What really got to me was that I just couldn't understand her crimes or the motive behind them. They called her a black widow.
Black widow to me can be defined as somebody who keeps marrying people who finish up dying and as a consequence of the relationship with you. So I think there's little doubt that she certainly was that.
Mary Ann made a bit of a living through her time killing husbands and children for personal gain. So that she is my definition of a black widow.
Mary Ann Cotton was a very ordinary woman. That's partly what is so fascinating about her. She was not unattractive. She had four husbands, 12 children, and a few stepchildren. She murdered 11 of her children for money.
Men found her attractive, but of course, as soon as they lost some sexual prowess, as soon as they lost their jobs or became ill and couldn't get the money to bring into the house, she was after the next man. And she was making love to her next husband while killing the husband she was with.
Everything that Mary Ann Cotton did pointed to her having an uncaring and brutal nature. Cold, calculating and chilling, Mary Ann killed rather than cared for her children.
You're not born evil. You become evil by your experience and what goes on in life as something triggers in your mind.
Mary Ann Cotton, née Robson, was born into a small mining family in Low Moresley, County Durham, in October 1832. Her father was a miner, her mother a miner's wife. This was the only life she knew. In 1842, when Mary Ann was only 10, her father died in a mining accident. What impact this had on the young girl, we can't ever know. But it left her mother, a young widow, with two small children to raise.
Mary Ann Cotton was born Mary Ann Robson. And the interesting thing about the surname Robson is that it comes from the Borders. The Robsons, back in Elizabethan times, were one of the Border Reaving clans, the notorious murdering tribes that lived up there in the Borders.
The Reavers, or raiders, were Scottish clans who patrolled the Anglo-Scottish borders from the 13th to the 16th century. They terrorised the border villages, thieving and taking whatever they could lay their hands on. Could Mary Ann have descended from the infamous Robson Reavers?
Right from the word go, there's clues about Mary Ann that she's a bit of a handful. I mean, she's brought up in a Methodist atmosphere, and the Methodists were very strict and very disciplined. But as soon as her stepfather moves in, George, she moves out.
So come 1848, 16-year-old Mary Ann decides to try and make a break and takes her first steps away from the hard mining life she knows so well.
The towns and villages of Durham in the mining areas were mostly dominated by mining and little else. There wasn't a great deal of opportunity for other work. So the likelihood of her becoming a miner's wife and continuing to be so was quite high.
She knew nothing else. She saw it coming. She saw it coming through her mother, and she saw it coming through her father, who was killed down the pit. If your father falls down a mineshaft, you know what you've got coming. Her first taste of middle-class life when she worked, age 16, for a colliery manager at South Hetton. I think she might have had a taste there, that life actually could be a bit different.
Mary Ann Cotton wouldn't have had a particularly enjoyable or easy life working as a domestic servant or a nursemaid. The days would have been very long, up at dawn, to bed, you know, after the person that she was working for had gone to bed.
She would be a cleaner and a cook and a maker of fires and somebody who cared and tended people when they were not good, particularly children.
The lady she worked for had at least 12 children, so there was a lot of work involved. And I think her experiences with them may have given Mary Ann a lifelong dislike of kids.
Life as a domestic is a thankless one. Fortunately for Mary Ann, her saviour comes in the shape of William Mowbray, who she marries in 1852. The newlyweds immediately leave for Cornwall, where Mowbray has secured a job on the railways. Far from being an escape from the drudgery of a mining life, the West Country brings its own miseries, and Mary Ann finds herself surrounded by death.
It seems she had four or five children in Cornwall, in a kind of railway excavator's shanty town, and none of them lived. Now, the 19th century didn't really talk about depression, and it didn't really talk about mental illness. But if I was going to think about where Mary Ann begins to feel ill in some way, I would say losing four or five children in a railway shanty town, far away from home, aged 20 years, not good.
So did the children she had in Cornwall die of natural causes or at the hands of a ruthless killer? Is this where Mary Ann started on a fatal path that would end with a noose around her neck? It's always difficult to comprehend what drives a person to kill. And in a bid to understand our Victorian lady killer, Mary Ann Cotton, I've really had to look at the life she lived. By 1857, Mary Ann and William returned from Cornwall to County Durham with one surviving child in tow, a little girl called Margaret Jane. The mining industry is booming and William soon gets a job down the pits. Mary Ann is once more back in the life she was trying so hard to escape from.
The population of County Durham increased from about 150,000 in 1801 to about 1.2 million in 1901. So there's a massive change in population.
The Industrial Revolution was at its height and coal was in big demand. Britain was constructing, manufacturing and exporting both at home and across its vast empire.
As the collieries expanded in the 19th century, so did the colliery villages. And it had a massive impact on the people who were living there. There was people coming in from all over the country. And the most direct impact it had on people's lives was the pressure it put on services. There was more demand for houses, there wasn't much sanitation. It affected everybody's life in every aspect.
The priority of the coal owners was to find accommodation for the miners to live in. You wouldn't necessarily have churches, for example, or something to keep the population stable. Pubs would be built straight away, they were the priority.
By 1857, Mary Ann may have been resigned to her lot and she starts to rebuild her family with William. She gives birth to a girl, Isabella Jane, in September of 1858. More children quickly follow.
you could have a situation where you had six or seven children in a family sleeping in a damp room, say 8 foot by 8 foot, along with the mum and dad all sleeping cramped together. Very unpleasant situation.
Families of 8, 10, 12, 16 children were not uncommon, and women could spend 20, 25 years basically in the process of pregnancy, childbirth, those first early months, and then it repeating itself over and over again, and it had a massive impact on a woman's health.
On June the 22nd, 1860, Mary Ann's first child from Cornwall, Margaret Jane, dies. The following year, Mary Ann has another baby. She also calls this child Margaret Jane. 2 years later, she has a son, John Robert. By 1863, Mary Ann's life is a drudgery, a continual battle to feed and clothe her growing family.
The miner's wife was involved in looking after the family, in cooking, in doing all the washing and bringing up the children. The childbearing role was a major job for a miner's wife.
Mary Ann knows from first-hand experience how dangerous mining life can be. Her father had died in a mining accident, so she quietly encourages William to take out an insurance policy should their circumstances take a turn for the worse.
But in the 19th century, private capitalist companies are beginning to understand that there is a huge market in penny a week subscription. And the man from the Prue becomes a famous figure in working class terrace streets.
The insurance policy pays off as young John Robert dies aged 12 months. He's soon followed by his father. William Mowbray dies of typhus fever in January 1865. Mary Ann makes her first claim.
Mary Ann gets £35 from insurance company for the death of William Mowbray. £35 then is about half a year's labourer's wages. So it's a tidy sum.
Mary Ann, now widow, moved to Seaham Harbour with her two remaining daughters. Within weeks of arriving, one of the girls, Margaret Jane, dies of typhus fever. She was just 4. Perhaps feeling the stress of losing more children, Mary Ann sends her remaining child, Isabella, to live with her mother. Mary Ann Cotton is now free from children and has no husband. She has cleared the decks once more.
In the 19th century, people did move on quite quickly from marriages, both men and women. It was very, very hard to be on your own, no matter what sex you were. Quite often you get men who've been widowed, normally through child, their wife's died in childbirth, moving on quite quickly because they need somebody to look after the children, to look after the household. And it's the same with women. There were very, very few alternatives available.
By 1865, Mary Ann tries once again for a different life. She starts to work as an untrained fever nurse at an infirmary in Sunderland. It is here that she meets and befriends a patient, George Ward. Within months, she becomes Mrs. George Ward.
Marriage is incredibly popular in the 19th century. And in the coal field, there's an obvious reason for it. It's called woman labour power. All those things Mary Ann did so well, cook or clean, skivvy, produce children and offer sexual relationships, all these things are in high demand. Marriage was a way in which men got the labour power and women got some kind of support and a very small amount of legal protection.
Mary Ann finds life as Mrs. George Ward pretty dull. even without any children to look after. Never one to sit still, Marianne soon embarked on an affair with a married man, Joseph Natras. A year and 2 months after her marriage to George Ward, he suddenly dies of cholera and typhoid fever. Marianne then replies to an advert in the local paper for domestic help from a recently widowed man, James Robinson.
James Robinson had a wife and 5 children. The wife died and the youngest of the children was sickly, so he clearly felt the need to have some sort of female help in the house. Apparently only Marianne really caught his attention. She may have attracted him physically.
The Robinson baby dies within days. A few weeks later, Marianne is summoned back to her poorly mother's side at Seaham Harbour.
She went to visit her mother. She stole some things from her mother. Her mother noticed and taxed her with it. And the next thing we know, her mother's dead.
After the death of her mother, Marianne returns to Robinson household with a daughter from her first marriage, Isabella Mowbray. Within weeks, 2 of Robinson's 4 surviving children are dead, and so too is Isabella. 4 months later, in August 1867, Marianne, again pregnant, marries James Robinson. Their daughter Margaret Isabella is born in November. She lives for just 3 months. Death seems to follow Marianne around. She has decimated the Robinson family. So how could James even contemplate marrying this woman?
In the society in which she lived, he was virtually obliged to. He would have been disgraced otherwise. But on the other side of the coin, his 3 sisters didn't like Marianne. So he was battling in 2 different directions. They certainly didn't want anything to do with this woman, but she was pregnant. What was he going to do about it?
Margaret Isabella Robinson dies in February 1868. 4 months later, Marianne gives birth to George Robinson, the last of the children she would have as a wife of James Robinson. The marriage had finally crumbled.
He found out that she'd been doctoring his passbooks for the Building Society, making amateurish alterations to the amounts. She'd stolen £50 from his Building Society and got him in debt for perhaps another 60. The poor man had gone from comparative prosperity to near ruination without even knowing about it.
Her marriage to Robinson is over. But even with so many deaths surrounding Marianne, suspicions are not aroused. Deaths at this time are common, and a massive cholera outbreak sweeping across the area claims even more lives.
Even simple things like colds and flu could kill children in particular who are all very weak, but probably the biggest threat to health was just poor sanitary conditions and the effect that it had on people's lives. You get people dying of gastric fever, and in the case of Marianne Cotton, she used that to great effect to explain the death of many of her husbands and children.
I suspect that she was canny and that she knew very well that what she was doing was against the law. And in fact, that the more she did it and got away with it, the more she was motivated to keep on doing it. It was almost a feeling of power for someone who had absolutely no power in the rest of her sphere. She was nobody, and yet she had the power to get rid of people who were in her way and make them pay her way, as it were.
In a way, Marianne shows us a woman's industrial revolution too, although in the most perverted way. And this is an industrial revolution of the worst possible circumstances for women. And that is, death rates chasing birth rates up the graph. And that's basically what it's like in her environment.
The infant mortality rates were quite high. I think in some areas of the Northeast, as many as 2 in 10 children wouldn't make it beyond their first year.
Some nice hot soup for you.
The figures for the Durham coalfield are simply murderous for the 19th century. The Durham coalfield had an infant mortality rate of 180 per 1,000 live births. Bangladesh, at the moment, has an infant mortality rate of 52 per 1,000. And the English average is 6.
Ready for your soup?
The registration of deaths, the registration of births, particularly for children, is notoriously inadequate. Now, in this world, Mary Ann can become almost invisible. The deaths of children is not a big deal.
Life is cheap and children expendable. The high infant mortality rate proves to be a great smokescreen for a serial killer. So what was Mary's weapon of choice?
I think it was well known in the medical and nursing circles that arsenic was colourless, tasteless, odourless, and only really shows itself after the death, long after the death.
The poison arsenic is as common as bleach. It's readily available and used throughout the house to wipe on woodwork to kill vermin. It's used in candles, wallpaper, even in sweets.
Arsenic could be bought just like any other commodity in various kinds of shops, in ordinary grocery shops, in pharmacists and druggists' shops, etc., all the way up and down the country. The symptoms of arsenic poisoning will vary depending on the method of delivery, if it's done in a big dose or in small incremental doses.
It seems that she's murdering the children with tiny grains, bit by bit.
Generally speaking, we have sort of diarrhea, cramping, pains in the stomach and the intestines.
Mary Ann has found the perfect killing method and she goes undetected. She has now murdered up to 11 members of her own family. By the beginning of 1870, she's once again without the responsibility of children, and she's searching for husband number 4. In trying to understand Mary Ann Cotton's story, I have discovered a woman who has scant regard for human life. By 1870, at the age of 38, she had already killed up to 11 members of her own family, and she didn't stop there.
I think moving around gave Mary Ann an opportunity to commit crime, certainly, because people would not necessarily know her history, and the fact that she remarried several times, they wouldn't necessarily even know what her previous names were. So she had an opportunity in County Durham that maybe she might not have been able to pursue in other parts of the country.
By March 1870, Mary Ann is on the lookout for meal ticket number 4. She decides to move in with an old friend, Margaret Cotton, her widowed brother, Frederick, and his 2 small boys, Fred Jr. and Charles. Mary Ann is already making plans.
She was there several weeks, and in that time, Margaret Cotton was unwise enough to tell Mary Ann that she'd saved about £60. Now, if anything was to happen to Margaret Cotton, she had no children, that money would go to Frederick.
3 weeks after Mary Ann Cotton's arrival, Margaret Cotton dies. Her former lover, Joseph Natras, takes lodgings on the same street to Mary Ann and the Cotton family.
She'd done much to try and catch up with Natras, it seems. Maybe coincidence that their paths kept crossing over. But there again, this may have been all part of the plan.
Natras, she always, it was said, he was the one, if any of them, she adored the most.
Not only is she sleeping with Natras, she's sleeping with Frederick Cotton. The inevitable soon happens.
The within weeks, she was pregnant by Frederick Cotton, and so he too felt morally obliged to do something about it, the honourable thing about it. But it's also quite possible that Joseph Nappus was the father of the subsequent child.
Mary Ann never gets a divorce from her third husband, James Robinson. She bigamously marries Frederick Cotton. Their child, Robert Robson Cotton, is born at the beginning of 1871. The Cotton family now have three children.
Nice cup of tea.
A year and 2 days after his marriage to Mary Ann, Fred Cotton dies of typhoid and hepatitis. After a suitable wait of 3 months, Mary Ann moves in her lover, Joseph Natras. But Mary Ann soon gets bored with the situation. She gets a job at a local hospital where she meets a patient recovering from smallpox. Mr. Quick Manning is a wealthy customs and excise man and a very eligible bachelor.
Once Quick Manning appears on the scene, he's obviously so much better a catch. It seems that Mary Ann turned against Natras, and now she wants everybody out of the way. There's no way she can persuade a bachelor like Quick Manning to take on kids from another man's marriage.
She does seem to be clearing the boards every now and again and wanting to start again. I think she's in her own mania. She's seeing the world through her own mania.
It's 1872, and Mary Ann embarks on a final killing spree that will be her undoing. On the 10th of March, Fred Cotton Jr. dies of gastric fever. On the 28th of March, Robert Robson Cotton dies of teething and convulsions. On the 1st of April, Joseph Natras dies of typhoid fever. It looks like Mary Ann has now killed 16 members of her family.
No one, not a single husband, suspected her. All these deaths of their own children from other marriages, all from arsenic. The husbands would come home and find their children writhing in agony, dying from arsenic.
But suspicions were being aroused by the local parish relief overseer, Mr. Thomas Riley, who thought there was something very suspicious about the number of deaths surrounding Mary Ann Cotton. She now has just one remaining child, young Charles Cotton, and she has plans for him too. She offers him to the local workhouse.
Here's another one for you.
She foolishly remarked to Riley that the boy's a weakling. He'll never grow up. Riley thought, looks healthy enough to me, to which Mary Ann replied, he'll go the same way as the rest of the Cotton family.
In July 1872, Mary Ann kills for the last time. She has fulfilled her promise to Riley.
Here we go, son. This'll make you feel better.
7-year-old Charles Cotton, the last of the Cotton family, avoids the workhouse and dies of a fever on the 12th of July. Mary Ann has now killed a minimum of 16 and possibly as many as 21 members of her own family.
She's looking for control of her life and of other people's lives, especially when they intrude on hers. It's a terrible kind of power, but for a woman in a century who has no power given to her, the power of arsenic might have been something almost fascinating, the power of life and death.
I'm not so sure she'd actually got pleasure from killing. I think she got pleasure from the start of the relationship and the build-up of the relationship. And I think the killing then became an expediency. It was the way to deal with the situation. The only way you remove people, you either get rid of them and they get them out of their lives so you can move on to the next bit.
Is she calculating on the next kill or a new life that she hopes she's going to achieve through the past kill?
She had no sense of right and wrong, and she didn't really feel accountable. She did what she felt she had to do. What was important to her was what she needed.
One needs to understand her more in terms of an opportunistic killer. She was quite self-centered. She clearly was antisocial. She stole. She was deceptive.
She was a great one for the insurance policies, and she was a great spender of money and enjoyed looking nice to attract other men. She was certainly a very detached killer. She saw that her needs were paramount, and therefore, if they weren't meeting her needs, she just simply removed them. So in that sense, you could call her very cold-blooded.
She certainly fits the profile of being aware that she needed to stay one step ahead of the law. Clearly, there are traits in her that show she was able to plan ahead. She was quite ruthless in her thinking.
Marianne Cotton showed no remorse, killing husbands, her own children, her stepchildren. And in fact, it was the death of a 7-year-old stepchild that finally led to her downfall.
I think certainly when you tell people that your very healthy son is going to be dead within a week and then he does die within a week, you're going to lay yourself open to suspicions.
The local overseer, Riley, is incensed, and he shares his suspicions with the boy's GP, Dr. Kilburn, who then refuses to issue the death certificate. The police are called in. A post-mortem and then an inquest are carried out the following day.
The post-mortem on Charles Cotton was carried out in an environment which, to our standards, would seem primitive and quite absurd. He was basically laid out on his stepmother's table, and the general practitioner went about cutting up the body and making his investigations. Dr. Kilburn conducts the post-mortem, but of course he wasn't looking for arsenical poisoning, right? And he ends up with a kind of a vague sense that there were some things that were not really right, but it was not really clear exactly how it is that you would interpret this kind of mass of indicators. He goes from the kitchen to the pub and says, "I find nothing completely unusual. I would consider this a case of natural death."
The death certificate is finally released to Marianne, and she tries to make her last insurance claim. But Dr. Kilburn's suspicions are such that he's taken samples from the boy's body for further testing.
He then took the contents of the stomach and performed what was a common test for the presence of arsenic, which is the Reinsch test. And so on that grounds, he says, okay, well, there's an indication that it might be arsenic. And then what he does is he sends the material over to Thomas Scattergood, who is a forensic toxicologist based in Leeds.
The forensic lab confirmed arsenic poisoning. Marianne Cotton was arrested the next morning.
Three bodies were exhumed from West Auckland Parish Church. Frederick Cotton Jr., Robert Robson Cotton, and Joseph Natras. For several days, there were huge crowds around the ancient graveyard.
Marianne Cotton, why did she kill her children? I think that's one of the imponderables, really. And I'm not sure it was ever really asked at the trial why she killed them.
There are significant things in people's lives, such as fathers dying or new stepfathers coming in, relationship issues with members of the family. I think it's very difficult to identify when these are going to take on a significance in later life, because they become different, mean different things to different people. But some people actually can take the most insignificant issues in terms of relationships or what's been done, and later on you'd be surprised how important they have become for them.
Given that she killed her mother, there was probably some ambivalence in her relationship with her mother prior to her father's death. And therefore, it's reasonable to suppose that perhaps at an earlier stage in her development, she had also suffered difficulties. Not only would there have been perhaps the impact, the personal impact of that bereavement, but there would have been also the sociological consequences for the family, in the sense of that was the bread earner that had died, and the family faced destitution. And that must have generated intense anxiety.
I think we can safely say that Marianne Cotton clearly didn't like children. And I think she got bored with them as she did her husband's. But what takes a person over the edge to become a murderer? Was it the death of her father at such a young age? Was it watching her mother struggle with the grime and poverty of mining life? What exactly does turn an ordinary girl into a ruthless serial killer?
The first thing we'd be thinking about would be pathological development. What contribution nurture may have contributed, what contribution the environment might have contributed, and then to look at what led up to the initial serious offence, which of course may have been preceded by multiple other offences. And then most importantly, to explore what might have led from the first serious offence to a second serious offence.
If they're psychopaths, then there's no feeling of anything. So mourning is not an aspect of it. We know that many do have some sense of regret, but they very quickly overcome that. But then the need to relive the fantasy starts coming back.
It certainly appears to be the case that the women serial killers do have a different profile, and poisoning and suffocation tend to be very popular means of killing.
Poison is a very physically non-aggressive way of doing, but a very aggressive way of actually killing somebody. It means you don't have actually physical contact with them, and you can watch them dying without having any qualms.
Poison is such a detached way to kill someone, give them a few grains of arsenic and then just walk away. But how is that even conceivable? How can a mother murder her own children?
Women whose development has, for whatever reason, not gone the way a generally normal development would go, their capacity to develop that bond with the child is compromised. They don't actually conceptualise the child as being separate from them.
I think Mary Ann Cotton was essentially a psychopath who perhaps killed people for the money, just for the sake of the money, just for greed. I don't think there's any justification in saying it was the social conditions in which he lived, because there were many other people living in similar conditions and many in worse conditions to Mary Ann Cotton. I think there was something in her character that made her an exceptional person in a rather notorious way.
With most women with severe violent behaviour, the victims are known to them.
Women serial killers, they kill with their caring, they kill in their environment, they kill in the house.
It's almost impossible to know what drove Mary Ann Cotton to kill. But whatever her reason, she was about to reveal a final twist in her sinister tale. The more I look at the life of Mary Ann Cotton, the more it amazes me that she managed to kill so many people. But our Black Widow lady killer was revealed one last twist to her gruesome story. While awaiting trial in Durham Prison, Mary Ann revealed that she was pregnant once again. Her trial had to be delayed for 6 months, during which time the horrific details of the Mary Ann Cotton case began to emerge to an eagerly awaiting press and public.
She was not thought to be fit for trial in a state of pregnancy, so she had several months of waiting to deliver in the cell, and that then became a window of opportunity for journalists to sort of go and investigate, you know, follow the trail, as it were, and to create a circumstantial case which made her even more sort of valuable as a news commodity.
It was quite a common tactic throughout the 19th century that women would get pregnant either during the trial, just before the trial, even in the earlier 19th century when they were in the same room as men, you know, during their time of incarceration, to get pregnant while they were in prison, because then they could what's called plead the belly.
I think, you know, there was no sympathy for her in the press. The British press had been pretty sensational for 100 years, particularly about child murders. Mary Ann really was a figure of hatred. An icon of murder.
There were rhymes made up about her. Parents used to frighten their children that she was coming if they were naughty. At schools all over England, because news travelled fast, there'd be playground games about her.
She's dead and she's rotten. She lies in her bed.
In a Victorian age, which puts so much store by this moral and spiritual superiority of women. Women were meant to be those who were going to save men from themselves. Women were meant to be those who were going to create a home. And in that home, all was going to be sweetness and light from that rough world outside where men had to do business.
Men wanted to believe that they could trust women. At the same time, stories like this made them aware that really they couldn't, especially if the women that they were trusting had some reason to feel aggrieved. And I think it made men uncomfortable that women could kill and would kill, especially to the extent that Mary Ann Cotton did it.
She does absolutely the opposite thing to what women are meant to do. She kills her husbands. She doesn't just kill other people's children. She kills her own. She's a monster.
Victorian society didn't like executing women. It was extremely rare for such a thing to happen. It had been 74 years since the previous execution of a woman in County Durham. So the mere notion of a serial killer being a woman, and on top of that, a woman who may have accounted for 21 people, most of them closely related to her, for the insurance money, was just incredible.
On the 7th of January, 1873, Margaret Edith Quick Manning was born in Durham Prison. The trial of Mary Ann Cotton took place during the month of March 1873. She was still breastfeeding her new baby whilst in the dock.
The public reacted to the Cotton case as though she were a witch. I think the British public just gave a collective shudder, because if there could be a woman like that walking around just casually giving arsenic to people who were in the way or whose death would give her a small amount of money, then she would just do it and nobody noticed.
Yeah, the press did have a go. They would, wouldn't they? And I don't blame them for that, and it's a great case. And she was an awful serial killer. On the other hand, when you see these people, they don't look like serial killers, hugging a baby, breastfeeding in court.
She made a terrible fuss when they took the baby away from her for the last time. And some people thought this was terrible, that a woman should be executed. People completely forgot that she had already killed 11 of these babies that she had nurtured and brought up, and that this child stood a very small chance of surviving into adulthood unless her mother was executed.
It took the jury just 1 hour to return with their verdict.
Rock of ages cleft for me. Let me...
Miserable. 7:55 a.m. affair. She's in her cell. Calcroft, the public executioner, comes with his assistant, Evans. They would put a leather belt on her waist. They would manacle her hands, and then they would attach the manacles to the belt. Then it was about 2 minutes into the yard, where a very simple scaffold would be, and she'd be asked to stand on the trapdoor.
Her newborn baby, Margaret Edith Quick Manning, is taken from Mary Ann shortly before she goes to the gallows.
Then they moved very fast. No words, no orders. Bind the legs, cap over her head, pull the lever, and down she'd go.
She She actually had the worst hangman in Britain, who was in his 70s, very frail and weak, had a reputation for being cruel, didn't used to hang them properly, didn't put the rope against the side of the neck so that the neck broke.
It took a grueling 3 minutes for Mary Ann Cotton to suffocate. Her body was then cut down and placed in a coffin, a burial within Durham prison grounds.
I think Mary Ann Cotton's legacy throughout the country now, I don't think many people will have heard of her, but if you come to Durham and you mention the name Mary Ann Cotton, you immediately get the reply, Mary Ann Cotton, she's dead and she's rotten, which are the words of what's is a skipping rhyme that children used, and you still get that today.
The truth is, we can never, ever get to it, why a woman should murder in that way, on that scale. Or actually, why she should murder at all. Why did Mary Ann Cotton kill like she did? Answer, no idea.
Mary Ann Cotton very nearly got away with mass murder. If I'd written Mary's story as one of my novels, I don't think anyone would have believed me. From Mary Ann's family, her third husband, James Robinson, and their son, George, escaped death. Her only other surviving child was Margaret Edith Quick Manning. Born in Durham Jail, she was adopted, changed her name, and she went on to live a long and happy life.